Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
This is Catherine Hunter, who did the producer,
producer director,
and the genesis of the idea, which was dusting away somewhere, wasn't it? Nobody was thinking about John Russell, and has brought John Russell back to life with this marvelous video, which is on the ABC. Which we're going to see a little bit of. And Jared, you know, Jared Henderson, he's going to demonstrate how little he knows about art tonight. And hopefully Catherine will give us all gaps. Okay, away we go. Did you want to play the...
Well, I knew he was a painter, but I thought he painted buildings.
More than a century ago, an Australian painter lived among the elements on a remote island off the coast of France. He worked side by side with Monet. He was a lifelong friend of Van Gogh and Rodin. And he opened the eyes of Matisse to color. John Russell was one of the great impressionists.
His story has everything. The fabulous, handsome hero. There's the love affair with the beautiful woman, Mariana. There are the exotic places, Paris and Belle-Île. And then there's tragedy. You want desperately for him to get his moment in the spotlight.
John Peter Russell is one of the great Australian artists that no one's ever heard of.
Catherine, we've got about half an hour before we come to questions and discussion. So, firstly, tell us something very brief about John Russell, when he was born, when he was died, when he died, when he left Australia, when he returned to Australia. So, just give us a bit about his biographical detail.
Russell was born in 1858 in Sydney, lived overseas for about 40 years, which is probably the reason he's not very well known in this country. Came back in 1924 and settled at Watson's Bay, and died virtually unknown in 1930. His paintings remained in Paris, and he really, yes, nobody really recognised what he'd done, including the Art Gallery of New South Wales.
So tell us a bit about yourself. I mean, I remember you from the days on Sunday when a commercial television company used to devote a lot of resources to putting very high-quality current affairs and other material to air on Sunday morning. So tell us a bit about your career at Sunday and how you moved on to other things after Sunday.
Well, it probably surprises people to know that Kerry Packer was very supportive of the arts. He started the Sunday program in 81, and it was always meant to be a magazine program with, you know, solid current affairs, but also political interviews, music, film, and the arts. He wanted to be like a British broadsheet on a Sunday morning. He just wanted to be able to wake up and get a sort of a really good coverage of what was happening in Australia and abroad. And he always supported the arts very quietly in the background. He only complained once, I think, which was about a Brett Whiteley film, which lasted for 45 minutes, and he thought that was a bit much. But that was the only time I ever got a personal complaint. And it was a golden days of television, and for me, for the arts, because we could do virtually whatever we liked. We could be reactive, we promoted exhibitions, books, Jan Events in the audience tonight. She and I worked together on a number of art stories together. When Shirley Hazzard was up for the Miles Franklin Award, we did an interview with Shirley. You know, nobody else was doing interviews with Shirley Hazzard. And those sort of things became quite important, I think, as in the time that people bought the books, people went to the exhibitions. We had a great audience who responded. And I think that's just happened recently with the Russell exhibition as well.
I suspect that Kerry Packer was right about the Brett Whiteley. I remember leaving after 5 minutes, going out, reading War and Peace, and coming back, and it was still going on. But those documentaries in one sort of way live on because they were done for Sunday, but every now and then you see them cropping up in some other documentary. So the work you created there in, say, 20 plus years seems to live on, although I'm not sure whether you and your colleagues get the credit for it.
No, we don't, but I guess that's the other thing. If you go back to the National Film and Sound Archives in the 1950s and 1960s, we really did love our artists and we documented. You know, I've seen fantastic footage of Dope Bell, of Margaret Olley, of Sidney Nolan, and it was just part of the national discussion. And I think 70s it started to trail off, but 80s and 90s, they were great years, whether it was 60 Minutes or it was Sunday, it was the ABC. There was Peter Ross on Sunday afternoon, as I'm sure many of you remember. There was that very vigorous artistic conversation which no longer exists.
But if you listen to a number of commentators today, they will tell you that the 50s and the 60s were a cultural desert in this country, but what you're saying is that they weren't.
Absolutely not. And you know, our art, I think it's about, and I do believe what I do is about building an archive, and I think it's really important. It's part of our sort of our history. And I think one of the great resources in the Russell documentary were the letters. He was a great letter writer. I don't know how many of you actually saw the film, but he wrote letters to Tom Roberts back in Australia. He and Van Gogh exchanged correspondence. He wrote to Rodin probably 40 or 50 letters. And so you get the voice of Russell through those letters. Now, these days, we're not going to have that voice. We're not going to have those letters. People aren't writing and aren't sort of discussing their art practice or how they're making colour. And, you know, he was very keen to get the word back to Tom Roberts in Australia that Impressionism was so important and what was happening, and Tom Roberts didn't really want to know. Although he did take note of it in his painting, Cheering the Rams, if you saw the film. You know, he paints Will Maloney, a mutual friend of theirs, wearing a pink and white striped shirt. He really wants Tom to see what he's doing with Impressionism. And he doesn't get much response from Tom Roberts, but then he sees the painting, Cheering the Rams, where the shearer is wearing a pink and white striped shirt, exactly the same shirt. And it's that subtle sort of response, I guess.
So what distinguishes a documentary maker like yourself, a past documentary maker, from a historian like Anne Gelberly, who appears in the documentary? Now, she's, as you know, she's done a book, or two books, I think, on Russell. So where do you start off? Do you start off with the work of the historian, or do you start off on your own and then delve into the work of this historian? What's the process of putting something like this together or one of your other arts documentaries?
I start off with a huge respect for somebody like Anne Gelberly, who literally discovered the Russell paintings, which were buried in the Rodin Museum at that time. They'd been given to the French state in 1948. His daughter bequeathed them to the French state on the basis that they would be permanently and be able to be seen. They never were, never have been. That was a great tragedy of it all. They'd also offered it to the Art Gallery of New South Wales on the basis that they'd have a permanent space. They said, we can't do that, so they went back, they stayed in France. But Anne was the one who went into the bowels, the basement of this building, and found these Russell paintings and had a little camera and took photographs of them. Her first books were black and white, not very good photographs, paintings. And she started unearthing the story, and then she wrote that wonderful story, A Remarkable Friendship, which was about Russell and Van Gogh's friendship.
So I
start with her, and she is absolutely intrinsic to what I do. And I go and interview her in the first instance, and in this case I went back a second time and I knew more and knew what I needed from her.
So tell us about, for this documentary, which many of us have seen, which was, as you know, a remarkable success, but tell us about your own travels. Anne Gelberly's in Melbourne, but you've gone further than Melbourne, haven't you? What are your own travels?
It was a bit of a gamble. My films rarely get funded at the outset. They don't quite, maybe I'm not quite cutting edge enough or whatever, so I have to really basically almost finish making the film before I get commissioned, let alone funded. So it's always, I did get a bit of support from the Art Gallery of New South Wales and from Create New South Wales, which helped me get overseas. The ABC said, if we were to take it, we're not interested in just a straight biopic. So I thought, well, I'll take a couple of younger artists and maybe try and sort of realise Russell's intention through them. So I asked Luke Skabiris, a Hillel painter who had been with Russell since he was about 15, knew his work very well. And Ewan McLeod, who didn't know anything about his work, but thought it'd be fun to come along for the trip. And became convinced by Russell after spending some time on the island. So we went to this island called Belle Isle, in France where Russell had built his house, which sadly is not there anymore. And we spent a week filming. I don't set up anything when I film. There's no script. It really is just a little bit as it happens. So the painters were out there painting, and I was out there interviewing and filming and hoping for some big storms to come through, because Russell, we didn't get any storms, but I found some other footage later on. And it just goes from there. I don't have a script when I go out to make a film. Most people probably do. It's probably the wrong way to make a film.
I couldn't quite work out what the artists were doing there, but now I know. I noticed they were sort of well kitted out. That they put on some fine costumes, or perhaps they wear that all the time.
They wear that all the time. Oh, really? I'm sorry about that. Yes, they do. Well, I think I didn't want it to end. I didn't want the film to just be this sad ending that Russell gets back in his unknown. And I like the idea of him being rediscovered, not just through the art gallery exhibition, but I thought that Ewan and Luke coming, it actually resulted in an exhibition at Manly, which ended up being very popular, and it was their interpretation of Belial. So I think from across the harbour, there was Manly, there was the Art Gallery of New South Wales, and they spoke to each other, and I think it maybe just gave Russell's story a bit more life.
So you got support from the Art Gallery of New South Wales, and you mentioned, was it Arts New South Wales?
That is, it's, Create New South Wales it's called now.
So how'd you go with Spring Australia?
This is an informed question, I don't think they thought it was cutting edge enough. I can't go into too much detail there because I hope they'll support me in the future. I think they felt it was, Russell was for a certain audience of a certain age, but I actually think it's probably over 30 myself, judging by the response I've had. I don't think we need to talk about the 18 to 30s because they're not watching free-to-air television. It was tough. I only got commissioned in June for the film, which is 4 months before I went to air, by which time I'd done most of the filming. I just took a gamble. I thought, sons, they've got to realise what a great story this is. It's a no-brainer as far as I'm concerned.
We never know. If you were more frank, you might get more support from Film Australia.
Maybe next time. But we also had something, there's a great organisation called Documentary Australia Foundation where people could make tax-deductible donations. So we set that up and we put the word out there and kind friends, whether it was $100 or $50, people put in money and I raised a fair bit of money that way. So it's sort of up to me now to raise a lot of the funds for making my own films.
We're going to get back to Russell, but what you've got another one lined up,
haven't you? Oh, yeah, I've got quite a few lined up. I always work on a number at any one time. I'm doing one on Arthur Boyd for the Bundanon Trust for a travelling exhibition. There's a lovely old painter who died in 1996 called Justin O'Brien that I've been doing a film on Justin. I got a bit of funding through Cranbrook School where he was a teacher and through the Margarelli Trust, who have always been incredibly kind to me. Margaret and Justin were great friends, so there's a bit of sort of interest on that one. So I'm revisiting Justin. I'm doing two other films probably. I'm probably doing a film on Streeton for the year after next, because the Art Gallery of New South Wales is planning another major exhibition. Anne Galbally's very much a Streeton person as well.
Yes.
And
so tell me, this rated very well, didn't
it?
I think surprisingly well.
It beat 9 and 10 apparently.
On the night, which is... The ABC usually comes in third or fourth.
We did a lot of publicity, and I've got to say ABC came... The value of a promo, which is we rarely get in terms of arts, but they promoed it day in, day out for the couple of days before it went to air. Now, the value of a 15-second or a 20-second promo before the news, after 7:30 report, translates to viewers, because I don't think everybody reads their TV guide. So I think if they're watching ABC TV and they see something coming up and it's got the word impression. So I did my research because the ABC had a few other ideas about the title. I said, well, you have to get the word impressionist. And I did my research and it showed what response that word will get. Everybody loves the impressionist.
But you worked pretty hard yourself, didn't you? You did a lot of interviews, huh?
Yeah, I do all the interviews. And I also work with my old team from the Sunday program. We've all stuck together pretty closely. I have my same cameraman and editor who used to work at Sunday. It's something about television. People for television know how to make things quite quickly. You don't have the luxury of a long time to make a film.
I was thinking of that because you see it commenced in June and it's all wrapped up by November. That's a pretty tight deadline. So.
Yeah, we had 6 weeks and 2 days to edit the film. By comparison, Nolan, which went to air the week after, had 6 months to edit. And they had a budget of more than 900,000. We had a quarter of that to make a film for the same 1 hour. Time's up.
Well, this could be an argument for less funding.
I think it's an argument for dividing the spoils, so we all get the same amount. I get a bit more, they get a bit less.
So, before we come back to Russell, you're obviously, from the work you've done on Sunday and the work you've done here and the work you're planning, I mean, you're not just doing documentaries, are you? You're building up a kind of record.
Yeah, look, you don't make much of an earning living from a documentary, but we make films for galleries. So we'll often commit, Bathurst Regional Art Gallery will commission maybe 5 films from us a year. I did something for the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade in Japan on Australian architecture, a 1 hour documentary. So, you know, they were quick films that we could turn around. It was still an hour, but it was a great subject. Doesn't get seen on air. But so you have to diversify. You have to do a lot of different things. You can't just sit around waiting for the money to come for one film. It doesn't work like that.
So you're reading on ABC, I think it was close to 1 million views, wasn't it?
For Sunday?
Yeah.
For
the documentary?
No, I didn't get that. But the iView figure, I think I've got nationally maybe 340. It's not a huge figure. It was a bit less than Q&A. It's good for a 9:30 unknown time slot without a...
I saw a very high figure, but I don't know.
No, it wasn't that. But the iView is twice the normal. It's twice the average. So that's really good. And it is going to be an iView. It's on iView forever. You sell your soul, really. You have to be on iView for about 7 months, I think.
Well, that's right, provided someone will buy it. There's nothing wrong with selling yourself, provided you've got a market.
Well, you need to get these... I want an audience. I want people to see the films. And what happened with this is the gallery had an unprecedented upturn in visitors.
Well, tell us about the gallery, because I think what was the upturn after your documentary?
I think it tripled, except on Saturdays and Sundays, and was more. So everybody was coming in saying they'd never heard of Russell. They said the gallery hadn't got the word out about Russell, had seen the film, and they were coming. And they were very happy.
Now, I know you weren't the curator of the gallery, but that exhibition, but that was a very substantial... Would that have been the most substantial collection of Robert's...
Russell in for, yes, ever.
Ever?
Yeah, there was a really fabulous exhibition in 2001, which was the work of Matisse, Monet and Russell side by side, which was a very beautiful exhibition. Probably the best of Russell's, and as alongside his peers of the time. And that was the last time they did an exhibition. So, and there was a retrospective about 40 years ago. So it was time.
It was in the 60s.
Yeah.
In Melbourne.
Yeah.
So.
But mostly these paintings have now gone back to France, and they're back in this fairly miserable storage room. And just wish the French would give them back to us.
So where are they now?
In
Brittany.
In Brittany, in a small museum.
But they're not on display in Brittany.
No, they're never on display. Except they came out at a really important exhibition at the National Gallery in London. At the end of 2016, they had a big exhibition of Australian Impressionism. So you had Street and Roberts in Condor, and Russell, and he was the head of the exhibition. So that was fantastic. But they borrowed a lot of good works from here as well.
It was his daughter that gave them.
She did. She gave them the French state, because they said,
put them under there, right?
But she'd also kept the painting. She was meant. Russell had left them all packaged up for his children. They're in piles for his 6 surviving children, and with their names on it. But he never went back to Paris, and Jeanne, his daughter, kept them. And there was the family split after that. But she kept them, and the Jules family then subsequently gave a lot of them to the Orlais Museum or to the French stage. But going to Belial was, I mean, we haven't really talked about that, but that was a fantastic place to go to. And as Wayne said, it's one of the few places that is still virtually the same as the Impressionists found it to be. It's no different. The buildings are all low-lying Breton houses. The landscape is unchanged. There's still no guardrails. There's, you know, a few falls every year, but it It's a wild place.
Ian McFarlane, the former head of the Reserve Bank, has done a book on, not yet to be published, but it will be published, on figures of the turn of the previous century who were known at the time but soon forgotten. And he makes the point, I read his chapter on Russell, that Russell's the other way. He was forgotten, but now, due to your work and others, he's now...
Anne Galbraith.
He's now quite a figure. So of all these people that he wrote about, who were pretty well forgotten when he did the first draft, that was sort of true, but it's no longer true. So he would now be becoming one of our best-known painters.
I don't think most people would know John Russell or John Peter. I prefer him to be John Peter. They've dropped the Peter in the last year. The curators made this decision. It was going to be John Russell. I think he's always signed his paintings JPR or John Peter Russell, which I think sounds more interesting than John Russell. No, I don't think so. I disagree. I think people know Tom Roberts. They know Arthur Street, and they know Brett Whiteley. They know Sidney Nolan. They don't.
But there's only four.
But Russell's not the fifth.
No. But he might be in the top 50, right?
I don't know. I'm not sure. Had anybody in this room heard of John Russell?
Yes.
Prior to
the
Art Gallery
exhibition of 2001.
Well, that's two of us.
But has anyone in the room not heard of him now? That's the essential point.
I think, you know, we love stories in this country. We love great Australian stories, and he is one of those stories who... You know, the letters are evidence. We're not sort of making him out to be more significant than he was. And I think he was significant because of his impact on other painters and his relationships as much as his painting itself.
Well, he could have looked on himself around the time he dies, about 1930, as something of a failure because no one much knew him. He never worked in his life. He sold very few paintings. He exhibited very few paintings. What was his problem? I mean, did he need a hat like Tim Fisher or something? I mean, he didn't seem to have any props. And
he was well funded. He had a lovely family inheritance. He made a decision early on when he saw a lot of his fellow painters in Paris who really were incredibly poor. Whether it's true or not, he made this apparently a decision that he wasn't going to sell his work. He wasn't going to compete with his fellow artists. He didn't need to sell, and I don't think he was he was ambitious for his paint, to making the paint the way he painted, but he wasn't ambitious for himself. I don't think he was looking for recognition. I don't think he needed it. I think he had this fantastic life on Belle Isle. I think it was back here. I think he was more interested. You know, he didn't paint a lot. He did a lot of watercolours and he built his boat. I don't think he was looking for that recognition. I don't think all painters do.
Do you think he would have been better known if he'd been starving in a garret rather than getting his funds looked after by permanent trustees? I mean, it was all very easy for him. He had an easy life in those days.
He did. I mean, it was a brave life, I think. I think it was really brave. I think, and the film makes the point that he went to a French... atelier, you know, he didn't go to the big studio where all the Americans were at, because Paris in the 1880s was huge, it was full of artists, it was a place to be, but he lived the life, and, you know, Van Gogh comes onto the scene, everybody thinks he looks very sort of strange, he's a strange man, and Russell just sort of saw something in him. I think that was the thing, so seeing something in somebody else, like he saw in Matisse. Again, if you've seen the film, he has quite a profound influence on Matisse. Hilary Sperling, who wrote the biography of Matisse, devotes a whole chapter to Russell, says that he changed Matisse's palette, and I think you see that in the paintings. And yet at the end of that summer that Matisse, he gives him one of the 12 drawings that Van Gogh's given him. So even then, I think he's saying, and Matisse really valued that drawing, which is now in the Philadelphia Museum, I think, but it's... I think he saw the talent in others. Even going to Rodin was relatively unknown when he was marrying his mistress of 3 years, Mariana, and commissioned a bust to commemorate their wedding. Now, again, that's sort of an unusual thing to do, but he had the money.
But looking the other way, what did they see in him? Because he's from Australia, he's an English speaker. I guess he learns pretty good French, right?
I think he probably bought them a few meals from time to time, but I think Van Gogh saw, I think you see in their letters that there was that respect, and he loved his blossom paintings he'd done in Sicily and later in South France, and there was that conversation. Look, he just had good friendships with them. I think Monet not so much. I think Monet didn't just sort of like the hospitality that was offered by Russell and his wife on Belleville.
So he had money, but he also had a bit of charm, obviously.
I think he was very charming. He was gorgeous looking. Mm. He was a boxer. He was a sailor. He was very Australian. I think he would have had a great impact. And he had a gorgeous, fantastic wife. Mm. And as Hilary Spelling says in the film, it was unusual to have such a supportive artist wife who actually, I didn't mention in the film, it was a bit of an oversight, but I can confess it, he had actually had 12 children.
Yes.
And it just, I don't know, I just got lost in everything else. And that was a bit I wish I had mentioned, because I think that was the amazing thing.
And how many, what,
six
half
survived.
A dozen survived?
Yeah,
six.
And I guess it wasn't that unusual. But
and she dies at the age of, what, 42?
43, yeah.
So she's pregnant a lot of her life.
And I think that would have been terribly hard on her, but it was not that unusual.
And she's living in isolated off the coast of
Britain. Later in life, they'd go to Paris a fair bit as well. They'd spend the winters in Paris or south of France. But with the house we stayed in, we rented an Airbnb on Belleville, and we found out later it was the house Matisse spent 2 summers in. So that was nice.
Oh.
And we can read the descriptions about this house in Hilary Spelling's
book. Okay, well, look, I think we've covered the general area, so Anne will now head off and
I want to ask a question.
In charge of questions. Many thanks.
Well, I'll ask a question. I was interested in the letters that when he wrote to Van Gogh and when he wrote, Van Gogh replied, they wrote in English.
Yes.
And can you explain why? Because one was Dutch, living in France, and one was Australian. Because they were all bilingual? Or?
I don't know. Jana might know that question. I don't know if Van Gogh spoke.
I just found that interesting.
What his French was like. I have no idea.
He wrote back in English.
He spoke, and
he wrote Vincent.
He did, but also the even using words like, hope to hear from you pretty soon. That struck me. I thought that was a relatively new way of using that word, but it was quite a conversational French. Maybe his English was better than his French. I don't know.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I have no idea. He seemed to write. Yeah, I mean, Van Gogh wrote a lot of letters to a lot of people, but mostly only in English to Russell.
That's right. I'd just like to ask you two things. I think you mentioned in the documentary that at one stage he burned a lot of his paintings. Do you know much background to that?
Look, it's Wayne Tunnicliffe is a bit more dubious about that, but it's in Sarah Turnbull, who came with me to France, and she wrote a book called Almost French some years ago, and she's also writing a book about Russell, which I think will be fantastic. It's going to be more literary fiction, less biography, although I think it'll be a crossover. She came with me. She's been studying Russell for 10 years. But she came with me as my interpreter as well. She got the fabulous interview with Giselle, who was a long-time Belliwise woman who loves Russell and just thinks he should be as well-known as Monet, and loved the fact that he loved their island. So she's the one with her research, and I trust her research. She's done so much research, and she's found where the children have talked about the burning of the paintings. Maybe they just weren't very good paintings. Maybe there were more Mariana paintings. They're just not documented. But I think he painted every day, and I don't think there's works there to justify those 20 years he spent on Belleville. It's one of those great, we'll never really know.
It's a bit like the story that he left all these artworks to the Art Gallery of New South Wales, and they offered them and they rejected them. That's not true.
Look, I've gone through the correspondence. It's very murky because his second wife had always said that she was going to leave her works to the Art Gallery of New South Wales, and she went back on that promise. So they ended up being distributed in collections all around America or family. So there was that bit that I've read all the correspondence. It's hard to tell with the Art Gallery. I think think they were offered, but they could never say, they were being honest, they weren't going to work at the One Point Display, they should have just said yes. Nobody would have held them to that, I don't think.
Thank you, it was very interesting. I did enjoy the documentary.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say, the queue in the art gallery, the weekend, the week before close, was fantastic. Yeah. I've never seen such a queue. And I saw old friends, what are you doing here? We're queuing to see Russell, it finishes on Sunday.
And a lot of, yes, I think this is, I do go on about this an awful lot, but I do think we need more arts programming in this country, and I think people would go to the exhibitions.
Yes, yes. And there's just one other thing.
And I think we all need to tell the ABC.
Anybody who went to Sydney University before 1990 would know very well about the Peter Nichol Russell School of Engineering in South
Wales. Oh, yeah, of course. Absolutely.
So the name has always been around.
Yes.
So Peter, just for background, Peter Nichol was his father.
No, uncle.
John and Terry were all the Dutch.
Yes. Yeah,
yeah,
you did.
Yeah,
I think so.
Was
yeah.
Expected to go into the
picture.
Hey, we can't pick it up.
Too.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Catherine. I thoroughly enjoyed your documentary.
Thank you.
I was one of those in the majority here who was not aware of John Russell, but thanks to the exhibition and your documentary, I now have a renewed interest. But I wanted to draw a parallel with the reference to the Art Gallery of New South Wales declining the offer. And that is with Howard Hinson. Are you familiar with
that? I'm very young. I've done a film for the Armidale Gallery on Howard Hinton.
Well, I'm so pleased you have, because...
And that collection, I think it's fantastic it ended up in Armidale.
It is one of
where
the,
it is loved.
One of the great Australian impressionist collections. And
does anybody know who Howard Hinton was?
Yes.
Well, I think you should explain.
I've seen what's on display.
Okay, just hang on. Just tell us who Howard Hinton was.
I don't know how he made his money. He was in shipping, wasn't he?
His family were in shipping, and it was with one of the... what were then major shipping lines. It was something like Howard Smith, who traded in the islands.
Yes.
And he also was the beneficiary of a significant inheritance. At the tender age of 18, his father had sent him on the grand tour, where he became an autodidact on the great artists of Europe, and came back and followed very closely the Australian Impressionists when they came to do their summer camp at Sirius Cove.
And he lived in a boarding house above Sirius Cove,
exactly.
So he could look down, and he actually went and stayed with them.
In a very Spartan existence, he was in a single room where he only had a wardrobe, no room to hang the paintings. He was buying these paintings straight off the easel from the Impressionists, and each year he would package them up and send them to the art gallery, until one year the art gallery declined his offer, and with no explanation.
That's right.
And that's how they went to Armidale.
And the Armidale Teachers College was just being set up, and they accepted them because they said this will be great for our students. And the old building is just beautiful, sort of a 20s deco building. So they were hung, this amazing collection of all these really important Australian artists were hung in that hall for many, many years. And for a lot of teachers, student teachers said it was their first introduction to Australian art because they were all country kids coming there.
It's now a collection of about 200. They're all in one room at the National Museum of Art.
And it's fantastic. Yeah, we made a film about it. Yeah.
So just tell us briefly, who was he?
Howard Hinton.
Yeah, briefly.
He was just an avid art collector who bequeathed his whole collection to Australia.
Yeah.
And it was an important collection.
Can you tell me what brought Russell back to Australia?
Yes, he'd had another son, his seventh surviving child, with his second wife, Caroline DeWitt Merrill. But I think it was another son who was interested in trying out farming. And they went to New Zealand first and then came back to Australia. I don't know what actually happened to that son. And the Boer War had happened. He'd had a lot of investments go bad in South Africa, I think. So he'd actually lost a lot of his money, and I think he came back here probably fairly penniless and lived in this fairly ramshackle fisherman's cottage at Watson's Bay. And that was another highlight, was going there one day. Woollahra Council was putting a plaque on the street where he used to live in Watson's Bay, and then asked me to come along and talk, and I did that. And then the woman who owned the house came out and said, would you like to see Russell's studio? And I just had no idea there was still... His original studio is there on the water where he looks straight up in the Harbour Bridge. And it's where he died. You can see the rock wall he was working on. And it's fantastic. And that was one... You know, you get gold. You get lucky when you make films. And the other time was finding the beautiful storm footage of Belle-Isle, which we didn't shoot. We didn't get a storm, unfortunately, but I found a French cameraman who lived on the island who shot those amazing waves and storms, and I think probably without it would have been quite the film it was. But you have to get lucky.
I have a question.
Just
one here
first,
and then I'll give it to you. Another question on the letters. Are they all in one place, and if so, where? If not, where are they?
You can go to the State Library of New South Wales. They're in the original letters to Tom Roberts are there in a manuscript that you can read. The letters that Tom Roberts wrote back to him Stan, no longer available. We don't know what happened to those.
Van Gogh's,
you can go. The Van Gogh Museum is fantastic, and they have all the letters online, so you can go and read them all. And they're incredibly generous. There's no... Unlike other museums, they don't charge whatever you want. They give you as long as you credit them. Whereas at Guggenheim, I had to pay, I think, something like $840 for two pages of Van Gogh letters.
No.
Recto and verso. I had to pay for, even though they're the one letter. So there is, you appreciate the generosity of places. The Van Gogh Museum has it's an amazing resource. So you go there, that I'd find paintings I needed, I'd ask them for it, that I could download a high-res image again without paying for it. You just love places like that. We really just want to share what they've got. And also the woman who was coming out here, the curator, I asked if she could bring out the tranny that was done, because she can no longer read the writing on the Van Gogh portrait, which says, to Vincent in friendship, amite. And it's beautiful, and it's in red writing, and can't see it anymore, but she bought the transparency so that you can lay over it where they've done their conservation work, and you know, they're just fantastic like that.
So before we go to the films that you showed, the paintings that you showed in the documentary, you filmed them here at the Art Gallery.
Yeah, and I've got a I feel very strongly that you can't just get high quality, high res images all the way through. You can get away with some. The Nolan film the week after just used JPEGs, no actual paintings, and I think it shows because it's about texture. And I think with Russell, when you film the painting, you see the paint strokes, and you don't get that in a photograph. So for me, it's always about having an exhibition that I can access and I can resource those works. You can't just use it. I mean, otherwise it's all static. It just doesn't have any real feeling.
Thank you. Two questions. Van Gogh had a very tragic life and was in hospital and things like that. Did Russell care for him then? And how did he meet his first wife?
Mariana he met in Paris, and they seemed to quickly move in together. Originally they said she was Rodin's favourite model and he met her through modelling, but in fact Rodin met Mariana through Russell. So she was just in Paris. She'd come in there with her brothers who are musicians. They would come from a poor family in Italy, and they'd come to try their luck in Paris. She was very beautiful, and she was a great artist model, and I think he just met her, but they were all living in the sort of same part of Paris, Boulevard de Clichy, or however you pronounce it, I don't know, it's where all the art studios were. And so that's, what was the other question?
His relationship with Van
Gogh. Oh, he didn't go and care for him, no, because he had all these kids, and he was stuck on Belle-Isle, which was a long way. It was a lot of travelling to get back to Paris and then to south of France, where Van Gogh was. But they had this correspondence, and Gauguin had gone there, and that had all ended badly, as we know. But I think in the same way that Van Gogh wanted to start this, you know, house, Ferrara, the yellow house, in south of France, I think Russell was actually more successful. You know, he did attract a lot of artists to his place, and he was a very great host. You know, he was the lord of the manor and lord of the island. He employed all the locals, he introduced tomatoes to Belle-Isle, he was they had horses here. Mariana used to ride everywhere. But I think all the artists came and stayed with him or stayed nearby, and I think he was more successful. But though he didn't, he was worried about, I think he thought Vincent would get better, and he didn't. And unfortunately, he never took up Vincent's offer to go to his studio and keep a painting to bring back for his art collection in Australia. We missed out on that, but he did give him the 12 drawings.
Catherine, I was interested that in film there was footage of one of his descendants. Can you tell me a little more, us a little bit about the rest of the family that had survived and what directions they went in?
No, I can't. It's a really quite a complicated family history. And I really only got to know Hugh, who was the son of Elaine, one of Russell's sons, and they'd ended up in Scotland, and physically, he was very like Russell. He was also, he and his father were great sailors, like their grandfather was, or like his grandfather. I did meet people at the exhibition opening. There's a man called Claude who was Mariana's relation. You know, there's a whole lot of relations on Mariana's side, but I didn't. And there's been a bit of a, I'm not sure how big the family is. I don't know. It was never the same. The five boys were sent to boarding school after Mariana died. Jan stayed in Paris, and her father went and lived with her. And they never seemed to really get together much after that. It was really, I mean, the boys didn't even speak English when they were sent to boarding school in England. They spoke their own language. It was a mixture of Italian, their local dialect, French, Australian, English. And it was, this one boy was sent to boarding school, the first one who was sent over, he arrived a week early. And his mother had just died, he didn't speak the language. It was, I don't know that side of Russell. It's. I think he was just so heartbroken, he probably didn't see beyond his own grief. And I can't even tell you how much time he actually spent with his sons in the ensuing years.
According to the Ian McFarlane chapter, the five sons all joined the British Army and all survived the First War.
They did.
Some were casualties, but none died, which was pretty lucky.
Yeah.
In 1418, so... A bit of like
Mariana died in 1907, so they'd gone. So that gives you an idea. So 1908, one of them, yeah. So, yeah, that's true. And none of them became serious painters.
So tell us, go on, Anne.
I was just going to ask you a bit more about. His state of mind when Mariana died. I felt that was when he burned a lot of paintings.
He did.
Yeah, so he was sort of in a self-destructive mode. And he kind of didn't have any way of knowing what to do with children.
I don't think, can you imagine living on that island with all those kids? I mean, he had housekeepers, but she was so important to him, I think. And I don't think they thought she was going to die. She had an operation. Sarah had uncovered the fact that she'd gone to a doctor who was known for, working with cancer patients. So that's, and I think she'd had an operation, but she just died very suddenly. And I don't think it was, but you know, she had had the 12 children as well. So she was probably, it would have been a tough life, I think, for her.
Then he returns to Sydney, and then for some, he goes to New Zealand for some shopping.
Yes, he
does. Did he do any painting there?
I haven't seen any evidence of it. He was just setting up his farm, and they were living this really poor life. And there's terrible descriptions. They were living in this shack, and yeah, I don't know. It was a much reduced lifestyle.
So you can say he was an artist who blew the family inheritance.
He absolutely. It was gone.
Catherine, I want to digress a little from Russell, which I'm fascinated in. But you've always fascinated me, having had the pleasure of working with you over a number of years. And for those of you who don't know, Catherine has what struck me as a tremendous instinct working with artists across the board, not just painters, but writers and sculptors. And talk about Russell seeing something in others, she sees something in a lot of different artists and who work in different media, and yet you seem to have a connection with them, at least in my experience and my observation. And I wonder whether you have a theory about where that comes from and how that works.
No, I don't. I didn't study art. I don't have an art history background in any way. But I'm not an artist. But I love hearing their stories. And I think you know what we do and what we did on Sunday was less about the reporter with art stories and more about just the interviews where you just let the artist talk. We did before Australian Story. We were doing a lot of stories where there was no reporter. When I needed an interviewer, I needed somebody to really ask, you know, tough questions. It was fantastic to have somebody like Yana there. But a lot of the time, I think it's really important to let the artist talk and to tell you about what they're doing. And I think I did a lot of fairly conventional artists. I did a lot of stories of Jeffrey Smart and Peter Carey's. But hopefully, I also did a lot of lesser-known artists like David Strawn. And, you know, I'm hoping to do a film next year on a sculptor called Bronwyn Oliver.
Oh,
you know Bronwyn?
Who does
it? Well,
she's all right.
No, she's not.
She's in the Hilton Hotel.
She is in the Hilton Hotel. It's my least favourite work of hers.
She's at the University of New South Wales.
And the Botanic Gardens.
Yes, those are.
Yeah, she was a fantastic sculptor. She died in 2006. It was very tragic. She died. She committed suicide. But I've been wanting to film her. I've found all this old footage of her. I found two interviews that have never been seen. Again, they're the sort of things you go looking for, and if you find something like that, you know, you've potentially got a film.
But I think what Yana's suggesting is that your stuff works because you actually listen.
I think we're a country, and I'm always interested by art in this country, you know, that it continues to be the case. Our art does not transcend national boundaries. It barely transcends state boundaries in many cases. you know, one of my favourite artists is called Joe Furlong. He lives in Brisbane. Now, if you asked anybody in Victoria, they never would have heard of Joe Furlong. And he was also, you know, had a maverick art dealer by the name Ray Hughes, who sort of kept him for himself for about 20 years. But I'm not interested in doing art outside of Australia. And it's a little bit like, I'm not going to put him on the same level, but I did a film on Glenn Merkin a couple of years ago, and Glenn's never wanted to build outside of Australia because he says, how can you understand the climate conditions? How can you build in another country that you haven't grown up in? And I don't know very much about international art, but I know about art in this country, and it also so often relates to landscape. And I think, as we tried to do in Belleisle, to match the waves, the ocean with the painting, so you've got a sense of that energy. You know, in this country, you've got so much opportunity to and that's, you know, with that Nolan film that went to air the week after mine, that's not mine, they didn't get the landscape. They didn't get what he was seeing when he was stationed out in the Wimmera during the war, and how important those, that being outside of Melbourne for the first time, that impact it had on him and his art. And that's the great joy. I think we have amazing landscape, and to be able to film that and make that part of the film.
Let's
start where we'll go back to where we began. I just wanted to ask a very basic question, Catherine. What actually first triggered your interest in Russell?
The 2001 exhibition that was curated by a woman called Ursula Prunster, and it's a beautiful little catalogue, and it was just to see Russell, Matisse and Monet all painting this island, Belleisle. I was just curious, and the idea of going there, it was a bit like Luke says in the film, he thought it was like Disneyland, but it didn't really, you know, it was a fantasy place. But, you know, to go there and just, yeah, I just credit that first exhibition I saw.
Had you heard of him at that stage?
No. I don't think most of us would have heard of him before then. I think Elizabeth Salter wrote a book, and she was the first one she wrote before Anne Gowberly did.
Yes.
And, so that was the beginning for me. And I don't know, it just seems to have hit a chord with people this time. I just think it, and it was so hard to get it commissioned, and I just kept thinking, somebody's got to see the light and realise what a great story this is. And it's my thing about, I'm always fighting with, you know, to get things on air when there's an exhibition on, because I just think if you can actually, if it had gone to air the week after the exhibition finished, I think that would have been tragedy. And the fact that people could actually go and see the work and know the stories behind that painting of Mariana in the fields, and they could actually relate to that. I mean, last week there was an exhibition, there was a documentary called Finding the Field. I don't know if any of you saw it.
Yes.
Which was about the abstract art of 1968, an exhibition called The Field at the National Gallery of Victoria. You know, it was a great exhibition, but it finished months ago. And again, you know, it would have been great. I think people would have gone in their droves to see the exhibition. But you know, I think it's important that we as filmmakers try and time it with those events. It's about a conversation.
You need a writer and producer who can meet a deadline, which is a lot of people can't do.
We did it week in, week out. We put books on bestseller lists. When Mao's First Dancer was... I got the manuscript from that, and he credits Sunday with putting him on the bestseller list. Kate Grenville with The Secret River, I got that as a manuscript from Text Publishing. And I remember reading that book, and you probably don't like that book very much. But
which one?
Kay Grenville book.
No, I don't.
Really,
no,
I knew. Oh,
but I like... But Anne does.
I love it.
Yeah, I like Kate. But I was in the...
that's another story. But I think when you know, the privilege of working on a program like Sunday, that people respect it, you know, it's a bit easier than perhaps other programs when you can bring up and say you worked on the Sunday program, and it was definitely not the Sunday show, as our producer used to say. So people responded, and that was the luxury of that program, and you could get these manuscripts sent to you, and you had that honour of reading Kate's book or Lee Shin Sing's book, and you could do a story, and people would go and buy that book.
But as you know, journalists, one thing journalists have to do is meet deadlines.
Yeah, and we did. And we worked 48-hour shifts at times on the Sunday program without going home. Ever. I mean, week in, week out, we would do that. And particular people on the program would do that.
Did you sleep at all?
We had a couch, and people would take it in turns.
They weren't all on together.
No. There were times when you'd be writing a script and somebody else would go and have a sleep, and then they'd come back and pick it up, and the editor would be going, no. We worked like probably 60 minutes. Brendan said he worked at 60 minutes for a long time. They were probably fairly similar, but there was certainly no 9 to 5.
It was easy for Laurie Oakes, wasn't it?
He just turned up and did a 15-minute interview.
I don't think it would have been. I don't think I would have gone to Ben Issues. I think I had it easier than him.
Catherine, what's your view as to why art has fallen off its perch and why it's not as popular as it was? What needs to happen to give it a kickstart?
I think it's as popular. I think people want the programming. I think if you... It's the broadcasters. I mean, I could tell you about the days when we worked at Sunday, and I would go out to cover an arts story. There'd be a reporter from the 7:30 Report, Sally Begbie, was the arts reporter. There was an arts program. There was a Peter Ross Sunday afternoon program. SBS had a program called Imagine. Channel 7 and the others would have turned up the Archibald, but probably not too much else. But we'd fight for stories. We were all out there. There would be cameras everywhere, and not just for the big exhibitions. And that doesn't happen. John Olsen would have a retrospective, and I think I've got this great story, and John Olsen reclining on a couch, reciting poetry to me. It was amazing. I just couldn't believe it. Except then I saw the 7:30 Report, and he's on the same couch, reciting another bit of Keats. And then he's on Imagine, he's also on the same couch. I thought, I wasn't quite to myself. But anyway, you know, the point is we're all there, and we're doing, I just hope Russell's proved a point. I hope there's a new sort of take on what can we do. My thing is we don't have a home for documentaries in this country and on the ABC, and it doesn't have to just be arts documentaries, but every year I get to see 32 documentaries for the AFI Awards, the ACTRA Awards, but most of these programs never get seen unless you go to a very short cinema release. And I think it doesn't just have to be an arts time slot. I think it could just be a one-hour documentary time slot. You could fill with great... We make great films in this country, but...
Just before we go to the final question, there are a number of people around the ABC, and I think I can fairly say, I think it's true of the Minister, Mitch Fifield, who believe that the ABC should be doing much more work in documentaries than it currently is. Now, the Minister doesn't run the ABC, but I think there are people on the current board who would probably hold a similar view. Now, I'm not saying this is the view of management,
There are some people around who believe that this is one thing the ABC should be doing within its budget, because they regard this as something that would be important and would last, rather than a lot of the programs they do, some of them, not so important and don't last.
But it's the only place that is doing the arts on any level. I mean, you know, to give them credit, at least they are doing it. You can't... Channel 9 is no longer doing it. Channel 7's no longer doing it. I mean, I used to be able to... you know, Kerry Stokes loves art, but he's not buying programs. Foxtel Arts was around for a little while. I don't think they're doing anything. So we've got to treasure the fact that there's... I think it's changing. I think if we can just prove that there is an audience... You could all let the ABC know how much you love arts filming. There's a place where you can go, I think, and type it in. But thank God we've got the ABC, because without them we've got nothing. And we've got... There is no other avenue. And I make films all the time and I can't get most of them to wear. Like, we've done 8 films at Bathurst Regional Art Gallery on some fantastic artists. You know, I thought a Bathurst and Beyond type series would be great. There's nowhere to put them. It's the same. So,
Ivy.
Yeah, Ivy aren't commissioning or acquiring material anymore, though. So it's only Ivy will only take material that's been on the air. My dream is to start my own arts channel, and so it's a pay by view thing, and get the films up, and perhaps get other people's films, and people then know that there's an arts gateway to go to. It's just a lot of work to actually do it.
That's why talking to Sky News. I mean, they're looking in new directions.
Last question. Catherine, you've done many documentaries and programs through Sunday on many artists. Is there one person who particularly struck a chord with you over the years?
I did love doing a film on Nolan, and I got... And Barry Pearce, who was the wonderful head of Australian Art at the Art Gallery of New South Wales, did his retrospective in 2007. He was drawing from the point of view of not knowing really what he thought about Nolan, because Nolan was a great networker. And I went on that journey with him as he got to sort of decide what he really thought of Nolan. And I sort of fell in love with Nolan along the way too. And you saw this great retrospective that took you on this journey. And that was my first documentary my first film I'd ever done outside of Channel 9. I had no idea how to make a film. Edmund came to my help a bit with the gallery, which was fantastic, and because I didn't have any funding or anything. I don't know, I think it's always the next one too. You know, you can't help but just get excited by the next film you start doing. I'm so lucky. We've spent time with Jeffrey Smart on 2 occasions initially, and lived in the village and been taken to see paintings with Jeffrey. That was very special. Going to New York and being with Peter Carey, and you know, I did 3 stories of Peter Carey. But then, you know, we're over 20 years, so that was okay. I wasn't just Peter Carey. I love Russell, but I'm really excited about doing this film on Roman Oliver next. I'm already thinking, you know, how I make a film on a sculptor. I have. Yeah. I think you fall in love a bit with every subject you do. You know, I don't know what makes hagiography, I don't set myself up as a critic. I'm not an art critic. I can't be. I don't have that art history, but I'm, you know, so maybe I do hagiographies, but I don't really want them. But they're not set up to be a critic. Hopefully people come away and make up their own minds about the artist. And we're just giving them the information. We're not saying... I might have overread Russell a little bit. A little bit.
It was pretty objective. I didn't think it was hagiography.
No, I don't... I mean, I think I did say something about the greatest... I don't think he was one of the greatest impressions. I think he was one of Australia's greatest impressions. But anyway, that's okay. That's small. It's a small thing. But in answer to your question, just every... I don't... It's probably only one author I didn't enjoy doing.
Who was?
I better be careful. This is a podcast. I'll tell you off the podcast.
We can take it off at the end. Tell us.
Helen Demidenko.
Yes. What a great place to end. Catherine, your talent and your enthusiasm and everything else has really taken us with you tonight. I hope you
have the best of success for the next well of your life, the next one, the next documentary. I agree totally with you about documentaries, whether they're about art or history or whatever. There is a hunger for it. And the very best of luck.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.